Good afternoon. It is 1:30 and welcome to House Finance. It's Friday, January 27th, and present is Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Seaton, and Representative Gutberg is excused today. And so before we start, remember your cell phones. And for presenters, just a reminder to answer questions through the chair. And today we will have budget overviews from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Department of Administration. Labor is up first, so if you'd like to come to the table. Commissioner Dryas is approved, and I'll let her introduce them. Just to let you know,
I apologize. Four of us came in here 2 minutes late. It held up the whole meeting, so I think I will do better. But you didn't have a quorum until the four of us came in 2 minutes late. So I apologize.
Thank you, Representative Guerra, and we will begin.
How are you doing?
Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record? And we do have two female voices, so if you're switching between the two female voices, would you just say your name? You don't have to go through the title or age.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Seaton and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Heidi Dragas. I am the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. With me here today are Deputy Commissioner Greg Cashin and Administrative Services Director Paloma Harbor. Thank you for inviting us here to provide you with an overview of our department's fiscal year 2018 budget. You guys have seen this slide before. The department's mission is to provide safe and legal working conditions and advance opportunities for employment. The department accomplishes this mission through its key program priorities of protecting Alaska's workers through statutory and regulatory consultation and enforcement, developing an Alaskan workforce for Alaska's jobs, and income replacement for injured, unemployed, or disabled Alaskan workers. On this slide are reference links to our mission and key performance indicators, our FY18 budget details, and performance measures for all of our divisions. So this slide, and I will have Ms. Harbor help me where necessary, we were asked to incorporate the following 10-year look-back slides to, provided by the Legislative Finance Division into our overview presentation. So this slide shows the department's general fund budget since FY 2008. It's important to know in this context that general funds means both unrestricted and designated general funds. The department's DGF includes the State Training and Employment Program, or STEP, the Technical and Vocational Education Program, or TVEP, and revenue generated by fees for service, such as AVTEC tuition and fees. The department's increase of $5.5 million since FY 2008 is entirely due to increases in these designated general funds, and we will be able to see that more clearly on slide six. This chart here shows the changes in the department's budget since FY 2008 by expenditure category. Total personal services expenses increased by $7 million over this time frame. This increase is due to wage and benefit adjustments, which include increasing health care benefit costs. It's worth noting, however, that the department has 212 fewer employees, fewer PCNs, in FY 2018 than it had in FY 2008. Also worth noting is the significant reduction to grants and benefits of $12.8 million, which is largely due to the elimination of multiple UGF-funded workforce development grant programs. So this next chart shows the department's general funds by division. Again, general funds means unrestricted and designated general funds. The consolidation of two of the department's divisions, Business Partnerships and Employment Security, into the Employment and Training Services Division in FY 2017 makes this chart a little bit difficult to follow. Avtec's general fund increase noted at the top right corner of the chart was comprised of $1.6 million in DGF and only $300,000 of UGF, which is a UGF increase of less than 1% per year. And as we'll discuss a little bit later on, the department is implementing the second of its two-year tuition and fee increase at Avtec in FY 2018 to reduce Avtec's reliance on UGF. Avtec does have a new director. Her name is Kathy LeCompte. She came on in November of 2016. The department will be working closely with Kathy to develop a strategic plan for Avtec that continues to make its programs more self-sustaining and reduce reliance on UGF while still meeting critical state workforce development needs. This next chart shows a similar picture to the previous slide, but it includes all fund sources. Again, the division's consolidation of two different divisions into one division that I mentioned before makes this chart a little bit hard to follow. As legislative finance has noted on the chart, the department's budget since FY 2008 has increased by less than 1%. This next chart shows the department's budget by fund group. The department's UGF decreased by $2.3 million, or 10% from FY 2008 levels. As I mentioned before, the department's DGF, which is the only fund group to see an increase over this time frame, includes the STEP program, State Training and Employment Program, TVET, the Technical and Vocational Education Program, and fees for service such as Avtec tuition and fees. So as requested, the next several slides reflect the department's budget by division broken down by component or program. Our rating of importance to the mission was based on guidance that we received from the co-chairs. Our rating of importance to the mission was based on, I'll launch right into those. Critical means a program that is directly meeting the department's mission. Important means a program that provides indirect support that would need to be reassigned if the program did not exist. And status quo means a program that has historically been funded, but because of a statutory requirement, but has no real impact on the department's mission or potentially hampers the department's functioning. The department was not given specific guidance for the rating of effectiveness, so we used a high, moderate, and low. Using very strict criteria for determining what is constitutionally required, OMB informed us that the commissioner's office was the only thing in our department that is partially constitutionally required. So the commissioner's office and the administrative services division has worked tirelessly over the last few years to identify significant budget reductions and operational efficiencies. This includes considerable lease consolidation efforts that resulted in over $1 million saved in UGF from FY15 to FY18. This next slide reflects the programs within the workers' compensation division. While the department rates the effectiveness of the workers' compensation division as high, we do recognize that there is some room for improvement. That's why we worked with the governor's office on HB 79, which was introduced this week. The department has rated the importance of the second injury fund as status quo, and the effectiveness of that fund is moderate. While the program works, many other states have eliminated their second injury funds, which facilitates the reemployment of injured or disabled workers, because the Americans with Disabilities Act largely fulfills this purpose, prohibiting discrimination on the basis of disability. The sunset of this fund is included in HB 79. Mm-hmm. One of the department's highest legislative priorities is the repeal of the workers' compensation appeals commission, which would save $440,000 in designated general funds per year. This has also been introduced this session as HB 69. The programs within the Labor Standards and Safety Division are critical to the department's mission of protecting Alaska's workers and are highly effective. According to statute, the Alaska Safety Advisory Council is responsible for organizing the annual Governor's Safety Conference, and that's a terrific conference put on in Anchorage in April of every year. Members of the council take that responsibility very seriously and do a great job with that conference every year. In fact, the council brings in more in sponsorship money than necessary to cover the costs of the conference. We've ranked the council's effectiveness as moderate because we feel the group could be even more effective if it were privatized. The council is interested in privatization and is currently looking to adopt bylaws, which is the first step in that endeavor. The programs within the Employment and Training Services Division are critical to the department's mission of advancing employment opportunities for Alaskans and our core service of income replacement for temporarily unemployed workers. This division, as I said before, is relatively new. It's by far the largest division in the department because it represents the consolidation of two different divisions. Through that consolidation effort, the department was able to eliminate 10 positions or 10 PCNs, reduce its UGF by over $300,000, and reduce administrative costs, which put an additional $1 million in STEP funds out on the street as grants to train Alaskans. The workforce development component of the Employment and Training Services Division has a few different ongoing annual programs that we've displayed on this slide. These programs are highly effective and critical to the mission of the department. In accordance with FY17 intent, legislative intent, the department reduced the general fund authority supporting the Alaska Construction Academies by another $600,000 in UGF in FY2018. The remaining Construction Academy training funding totals $1.26 million in UGF. If this legislative intent language continues, this program will be eliminated by fiscal year 2021. The department is very concerned about eliminating funding for the ACA and believes this is short-sighted, given our aging construction workforce, particularly as we work to advance a gas line project. Failure to train Alaskans does not mean these jobs go away. It simply means that these jobs will go to outsiders. The Vocational Rehabilitation Division is focused on delivering services to disabled Alaskans. These federally and statutorily required programs are highly effective and critical to the department's mission of advancing employment for all Alaskans and our core service of providing income replacement for disabled Alaskans. I wanted to highlight what's included in that last lower left column, special projects. Special projects means special federal grants that enhance the services we provide through our client services program. These include supported employment, which is allocated to youth with the most significant disabilities, and assistive technology, which helps disabled Alaskans test and identify technology that can assist them in their daily lives as well as in seeking employment. Alaska's Vocational and Technical Center, or AVTEC, in Seward, is critical to the department's mission of advancing employment opportunities for Alaskans. AVTEC is also highly effective, with an average graduation rate of 88% over the last 5 years. Also, over the past 5 years, an average of 89% of AVTEC's graduates were employed in their area of training within a year. The department's budget includes a number of changes to AVTEC's budget. We are switching $184,000 in UGF to program receipts to reflect a 7.5% increase in tuition and fees to support overall programs in FY18. As I mentioned previously, this is the second year of our two-year tuition and fee increase. We are also switching $192,000 in UGF to program receipts related to revamping the culinary arts program. One full-time instructor position will be fully supported with receipts generated by the program. We are reducing our plumbing and heating and construction program offerings from twice per year to once per year to better align with demand and realize an instructor workload savings of over $50,000. Again, AVTEC has a new director, and the department will be working very closely with her to develop a strategic plan for AVTEC to reduce its reliance on UGF. That is the department's presentation. Thank you very much, and we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Committee have questions? Representative Guerra.
Two questions, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Commissioner, do you know what percentage in general funds your department's been cut since you've been commissioner, going through to the governor's FY18 proposal? Roughly.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I believe that's roughly 37%.
And then on the Workers' Comp Commission, honestly, I can go either way on that, so a cost savings is important. And I guess we'll hear the bill, but have we done an analysis that if we save $400,000 through the Workers' Comp by eliminating the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, we might not need another, because these cases automatically go, you know, they automatically go to the court system. There's no way to stop it. And there's a very large number of cases. Have we done an analysis that it's not going to require us to hire another Superior Court judge, which that's, you know, that with a staff member in an office, and all of a sudden you're at $400,000?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I wanted to correct one thing that you said. There, in fact, are not many cases that have been appealed. Those appeals have actually been declining over the years. We have all that information, which we will be happy to share with you, and we'll be prepared when that bill comes up for hearing. Those cases will be absorbed. Instead of going through the Appeals Commission, they will go to Superior Court. Last year, I believe the court system filed a zero fiscal note, simply because there were very few cases, and they essentially believe that those cases could be absorbed into the.
Good to know.
So,
thank you.
And you'll be prepared at subcommittee if there. You'll be prepared at subcommittee to have that data for them as well, so that there could be a subcommittee recommendation coming out as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Just one question I had on the spreadsheets under leasing. It's page 8. I don't know what that is.
For the record, my name is Paloma Harbor. I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Labor. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. The leasing component is just the way that we account for how we pay for our lease costs with state funds. So they offset a portion of all of our different leases across the state. This is what the commissioner mentioned, where we've made considerable efforts and we've actually cut the funding to leasing by over $1 million in the last 3 years.
And follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Kawasaki.
And the cuts to leasing has been because of saving space or not renting buildings or things like that?
Thank you. Again, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. So in fiscal year 2018, we're reducing our total leased space by 10,600 square feet for a savings of around $272,000. That's the latest reduction. We've made reductions here in Juneau. We've made reductions in Kenai. This one happens to be in Anchorage. We're looking at each of our leases as they come up to see, do we need that much space? Can we consolidate with another leased space? So.
Okay. And then just a comment. I don't remember seeing leasing as a separate allocation or program in other budgets. I guess I've just never noticed it. So that's why when it was teased out like that, I clued into it. But.
And Representative Kawasaki, I can't remember which report yesterday. There was another, one of the other departments had leasing.
Just lease space, okay. And then I just have another question for the commissioner. We're looking at scraping nickels and dimes together in a budget, recognizing that your budget, that your department isn't constitutionally required, but there's a lot of federal requirements that go along with some of the things that we do and we've taken on. I mean, has there been thought of either moving things in or out of the department? I mean, Avtech moving to the Department of Education, adult education moving out to Department of Education, for instance, if there's any other, I guess, sort of sweeping programmatic changes within your department, and why that may or may not be a good idea?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, oh, sorry. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair. This is Commissioner Heidi Davis. To answer specifically your questions as far as Avtech and ABE are concerned, I don't remember the exact years. I think my the colleague to my left, I think Deputy Commissioner Greg Cashin can remember those years. AVTEC and the adult basic education programs actually both used to be at education, and they were moved to labor because they thought the Department of Labor could do a better job administering that facility, that training institution, and that program. So to answer your question, I mean, we have looked considerably at the department for what is our essential core mission and what programs do we have that relate to that mission. And going through that process, I think, was very beneficial to our department, to the directors in the department, as well as the commissioner's staff. And we looked to see, you know, what we could do without, and that's what we've identified in these last couple years of budgets. We've identified, we knew we could give up some leases. When you look at programs, we looked at the one that sort of stood out to us was the Workers' Comp Appeals Commission. It was something that we no longer needed to continue. It was hampering our ability to effectively deal with workers' comp appeals. We actually transferred our independent living program over to the Department of Health and Social Services. So we have looked at a lot of different things in a way, and I've said this before in committee, but that was sort of the silver lining with respect to our budget difficulties, is really looking at our departments and figuring out what we do well, what we could do better, what we could do without, and what other departments may be able to administer better than we can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next is Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good job, Commissioner. This is really a department that you can look at the way it's put out. It's easy to read, understand where the money's going, but just consolidating the lease space like you have, the programs. I hope other departments look at the way you guys have been doing things. I might have missed it in your presentation, but on page 4, the increases on services, what was those funds that made that increase?
It through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's all of them, but we can get back to you with those specifics. We don't have those specifics here right now.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Bingham, if you'd give that to the chair, we'll distribute it to the whole committee. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. Commissioner, thank you for being here today. First question, you say that from, I assume it's from 2015 to now, or to this current governor's budget, we're down 212 PCNs in the department. So has that reduction had a significant impact on your ability to meet your mission?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, it does. You know, we see it every single day. We've taken very seriously the governor's the memo that we received from the governor's office about being very careful about what vacancies to fill, making sure that we can distribute the work effectively with what we have rather than filling positions. But it does make it difficult. We see that every single day in every single division. We are down significant administrative staff. And it's hard to convey to individuals that aren't seeing the day-to-day work of a department of how critical administrative staff is to making things go smoothly, making things function well, and making sure the public is served. I think the public is starting to see the consequences of significant cuts to staff. We just don't have the resources that we used to make sure that things are done as quickly and efficiently as possible. But we're doing the best we can with what we have and really trying to be smart about the cuts that we're making. I think it would be rash to make those decisions arbitrarily, and I think we've tried very hard to be methodical about where to make those cuts and where to make those decisions, where we don't fill vacancies. It's definitely had an impact on our services.
And if I could follow up on that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So can you give me some specific examples of where the public is seeing less services from labor and workforce development or from the Department of Labor?
For the record, Greg Cashin, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Labor. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, in the last two fiscal years, we've reduced our job center footprint by 3 job centers. So we had to close down the Kotzebue job center, the Barrow job center, and another soft closure in Seward. The job center happened to be located at Avtec, which is state-owned facility. So we do still have a resource room there and an access point for job seekers. But that's an example of having to reduce our footprint, and it has a definite impact on the public. And as I believe Paloma mentioned, we're going to have to take a look at our lease costs and our job centers going forward too if we have further reductions. So there will be an impact on service delivery to the public.
Thank you. May I?
Yeah. Okay. Representative Ortiz.
And then specifically to Avtec, I am not that familiar with the with the school, other than I know it's there. What are the biggest areas that you're helping to train our people for jobs in the workforce? In other words, where's our biggest contributions? Is it in shipbuilding? Is it in what's it in?
I can start. Maybe I'll pass it to you. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I really want more people to know about Avtec. I know Representative Wilson. We talked a lot about Avtec and our subcommittee the previous years, and the terrific work that they do training Alaskans from across the state. There are Alaskans from South Central that attend Avtec, but also from the interior and also from the North Slope and from rural other areas of rural Alaska. And Avtec has a number of program offerings for vocational education. I think one of the premier training programs is in our maritime training at Avtec. We have culinary arts, applied technology, so heating and plumbing, HVAC, refrigeration, healthcare. There's a number of program offerings. And I think one of the things that we have to do, and it's going to be difficult, is trying to, in the vein of doing more with less, is we want more Alaskans to know about the opportunities at Avtec. It is an affordable, although we've had to see some tuition increases, which were necessary, it is still, we believe, an affordable way for individuals, whether they're exiting high school and want to seek a career path for themselves or want to retrain themselves in a new career path. It's a terrific opportunity to get that type of education and really work themselves down a path of having good middle-class jobs, rewarding careers. I don't know. I might have Paloma add to it a little bit.
Thank you.
Following up on the comment on Avtec, how much is the Alaska Performance Scholarship used at Avtec on the certificated programs instead of the four-year college?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to the specific dollar amount. I will say it's underutilized. We had actually asked Avtec to make sure that the APS badge, the Alaska Performance Scholarship badge, was on the webpage to make sure that students were aware that you can use APS scholarship funds for Avtec. And we've been working on trying to get the word out about that. We can get you a dollar amount for that. I think that actually would be interesting to see. But I will tell you, it's underutilized.
Fine. And when we're looking at the subcommittee, maybe we can look at that, because it may be a way in which there could be more participation and more funding coming that way. So when you do that analysis or look, would you also look at the proportion of high school graduates versus older people, because those that are coming from the workforce would not have the opportunity to do that? So looking at the proportion of students that are coming out of high school, because you have to have graduated high school, you have to have taken the rigorous courses, and you have to have gotten a C-plus average. And so we don't want to compare that with older people being retrained that don't have the opportunity to use that, but what proportion of students that would have had the opportunity to use that do? And so Appreciate that. Representative Foster, is it on this point or another?
On this AVTEC and the scholarship point.
Okay, on this point, are you on AVTEC? Okay, Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I had the pleasure of serving on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board when Greg Cashin was our executive director, and had many opportunities to go down to AVTEC and see what was offered down there, and always a great experience. And on this line of asking about the Alaska Performance Scholarship, I guess two questions. Are what's required, like if you plan to use the scholarship to go to college, are the classes that are required to get that different, I guess, than to go to AVTEC? And where I'm going with that a little bit is just the impacts on rural Alaska, because a lot of times I would love to see more rural Alaskans go to AVTEC. And if we're going to try and get them to, use this scholarship, I'd like to know if the standards are different. How can I get rural Alaskans to take advantage of this opportunity and get the word out and let them understand how it's done, I guess. And that's something that if you don't have an answer now, you could come back later.
For the record, Paloma Harbor, through the chair, Representative Foster. We will verify this, but I do believe that there's different APS scholarships for higher education or what you might consider advanced education, and then vocational technical. And so there's different criteria for those APS scholarships.
Follow-up, Representative Foster.
Thank you. Maybe if I guess this is something we can get from that division or that area there. Part of the problem that we always have in rural Alaska is access to these classes, mm-hmm. In order to qualify for the scholarship. Okay. And so if they're, for example, if you're going to go to a college, maybe it's required that you have to take a trigonometry class. But if you're going to go to AVTEC, maybe the requirement is different. And if we don't offer those types of classes in rural Alaska, then we have broadband issues and all kinds of things. But bottom line is I would love to see more rural Alaskans go to AVTEC, take advantage of the scholarship program. How can we eliminate barriers to being able to do that?
Thank you, Representative Foster. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I just want to say thank you, Commissioner, for what you're doing in the department and looking for the best efficiencies to run it smoothly and at the best cost for Alaskans. I'm just going to follow up just a little bit. Representative Ortiz started a line of questioning regarding the 212 PCN reduction that you have talked about. And can you just help me to understand on that where the vacancies are? Is there loss of jobs to actual people? Were they absorbed into other jobs, or has there actually been pink slips where people have been removed?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, there has been a combination. Most of those, the 212 PCNs that are no longer in the department were through attrition, whether retirement or leaving jobs. We have had a few layoffs, however.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also a follow-up on Representative Ortiz's question. He had asked about the loss of employees and whether that was affecting things. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't know if you're allowed to say this publicly. I've spoken to a number of folks from both parties in the hallways, and folks are starting to get uncomfortable with the level of cuts that that we're adopting. So some folks, not all. But one of the cuts that I recall was a grant cut, so it wasn't reflected in a loss of employees. I mean, you tried to save money through grants that to people that don't pay state salaries. And there was one that sticks out of my mind, which was a program you had 2 years ago that helped in the schools fund counselors that steered youth towards jobs. And I guess now that that is gone, and you've had time to reflect, was that a program that really didn't have much impact on job opportunity, or was that a program that we regret cutting?
For the record, Paloma Harbor, through the chair, Representative Guerra. I don't believe there was ever an argument of whether or not the Alaska Youth First program, which is the one that was cut a few years ago, was effective or not. I think it was just the fact, or potentially, that, well, one, the state budget situation is what it is, and then, again, looking at what's essential to the department's mission, and there's some philosophical belief differences of where what Department of Labor should be doing, adult training, AVTEC, adult basic education, those things that came from education over to our department, versus what education should be doing. You know, whoever you ask might have a different opinion on that. But I don't think that the program was ineffective. I would say that it was highly effective in things like we had healthcare academies that we were able to do with it and other important opportunities to get high schoolers interested in opportunities, but we're in the situation we're in.
Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, just following up on what Paloma said, I think one of the things that I believe the department has to do is we have to expose young Alaskans to opportunities in career and technical education. If you don't give them an opportunity to explore an interest, whether it's in construction or in healthcare or in engineering or in plumbing or in pipe fitting, if you don't pique their curiosity, you don't capture them later on. They don't understand or aren't aware of the opportunities. Not just fulfilling careers, but these are really good middle class jobs. And it's a problem because we need more skilled workers in these areas. And I feel that we can't do our job as a department leading the way for workforce development in Alaska if we don't get in early and talk to these young people and their parents and their counselors about careers in career and technical education. I also want to go back to something else that you mentioned about difficulties with respect to these cuts and what Representative Ortiz had said about the 212 jobs that we've seen eliminated over the last 10 years. I think if you would talk to Alaskans that have had dealings with the department, they definitely feel it. One area that I can think of is in wage and hour. We get a lot of complaints about how we can't respond quickly enough. We're strapped for funds. Wage and Hour has a lot of UGF funds, and we are not able to hire fill positions as we used to. And what that does is it puts the public at risk. You know, we enforce wage and hour laws. Occupational Safety and Health keeps Alaska's workers safe and does investigations when there are incidences that happen at the workplace. When you cut government services, you hamper any department's ability to offer those services, and those two particular components of our department protect the public. And we are feeling that. We feel it even in workers' compensation, where we haven't filled as many positions in work comp. The commissioner's office is half the size that it used to be when I came into this position, which has been very difficult, given the sometimes monumental tasks it takes to try to do more or do as much as you can with so much less, and trying to manage that workload and figure out how best to utilize the staff and the program funds that you have. So it's been difficult.
Thank you, and we're about out of time. So Representative Wilson, do you have a very quick question?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the difficulties that we've had is we compete within the state between the university, Department of Labor, education, the private sector when it comes to training Alaskans. And how we pull that all together is where we really have the savings and where we could do the best for those who train. But those are separate budgets, and it makes it very difficult when it all sits that direction. But we have to stop competing within the state itself and make sure we do what's best for everybody and do our strong programs.
And I'd just like to say that it's very difficult when you have a single department, a silo, and it affects so many other departments, such as we're talking about with in the high schools and where those lines are drawn, because it can be really effective in another area, and those crossover points are hard for subcommittees and the full committee to address. One thing else I wanted to ask before we adjourn or leave this is the DG on slide number 9, both the DGF from Workers' Comp Appeals Board and the Second Injury Fund. That's DGF. Where does that come from? What is the alternate sources where that revenue would go if it was eliminated from this place and still stay within designated general fund?
Okay. For the record,
and if it's a really long answer, you can save it for subcommittee.
Sure. For the record, Paloma Harbor, Chair Seaton. For the Appeals Commission, it's a fund source called the Worker Safety Compensation and Administration Account. And that comes off of premiums, workers' compensation premiums. So if we save money on the workers' compensation programs, it impacts premiums. The Second Injury Fund is also paid through insurance. So it's a self-supported program, but again, it would save employers money if the program, they didn't have to fund the program.
So a question, if these two items go away, is this the only utilization, is this the only designated route this would go so that it would save premiums, but it wouldn't be diverting, wouldn't allow that money to be used in another critical area that you have? Is that?
Mr. Chair, no, that the WISCA funds is what we call them. I had Paloma speak because I can never quite remember what the WISCA means. But it also funds the workers' compensation division as well as our occupational safety and health.
Thank you very much. And with that, we'll look forward to some follow-up in the subcommittee. And we'll take just a brief at ease while we switch presenters. And thank you very much. It was very helpful. We're back in order, and we have before us the Department of environmental conservation, and I just let everybody know that we'll have to cut off at 2:50, about a half hour to go through, so we will hold questions. If anybody needs a question just for clarification, those can be asked, but for drilling down in a department, we'll wait and come back, so make notes on your paper. Welcome, Commissioner. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and then go ahead and start with your presentation.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and to my right, Tom Cherian. He's our Admin Services Director. Appreciate the opportunity to address the Finance Committee. And I will be quick today, because I know you're tight on time. DEC's missions protect human health and the environment, and what we deliver to the Alaska public is clean water to drink, healthy air to breathe, safe food to eat, and no harmful contamination in the environment. That's what the public should expect from us. Well, we do it by setting standards, incorporating those standards into permits and plans. We do compliance assistance and enforcement, and we also fund water and sewer infrastructure around the state. Our total UGF in the governor's proposed budget is a little over $15 million. That's about a third of 1% of the total state UGF. So if you look at both GF, all the GF, UGF and DGF combined, that equates to about 37 cents per day per Alaska worker, or about 17 cents a day per Alaska resident. So that gives you an idea of the scale of our UGF and DGF in our budget. This next slide, you'll see that our peak in terms of our UGF, our GF, total GF, occurred in fiscal year 14, and since then it's been going down. And of course, this is not inflation adjusted, but so that would make it even a little bit more dramatic. That decrease is a result of some efficiencies, consolidations, and I'll be talking a bit about that, some examples here in a bit, trimming back some programs and doing some fund switches. We've gone from UGF, we've had about almost a 36% decline in our UGF from fiscal year 14 to the current proposed 18 budget. Some of that's been offset by increased fees or other fund switches, and I'll get into some of those. If you look at the far right bar for fiscal year 18, about one-third of that bar would be, $15 million of that would be UGF, and about $30 million would be DGF. And of that DGF, about half would be from the response fund, the surcharge on crude oil production, and a little bit on refined products, and half would be other fees. So that kind of gives you an overview of our makeup of our budget. Another similar chart, it's not adjusted for inflation. The only thing I'd really point out on this page is that box in the upper right corner. It just points out that most of the DEC's budget is for personal services and contract services. And so when we see increases in our budget in any place, or where it might not have declined as much as you might expect with the cuts, part of that's just because of labor contracts and health costs. That's, you know, things haven't grown. It's just some of those costs just keep going up. On this chart, what we're looking at, the only thing I'll point out is on that we see those two lines converging kind of in the bottom right. The reason that admin services went up a little bit over this last year is actually cost savings. It doesn't look like that on this graph. But what it is we've been trying to consolidate administrative services functions, both within DEC. And so this represents actually some water administrative people and some of those needs being shifted over to Tom Cherian's division to try to realize some efficiencies by trying to consolidate those admin services. We've also been consolidating admin services at a state level among departments and shared services in the division or department administration, which I'm sure you've heard about. Examples of efficiencies. On page 6 here, I just talk that top line. You can see at SPAR, it didn't decrease this year. It just kind of stayed level the last couple years. And even though they've taken some cuts in that department, it's been relatively steady. There's no UGF in SPAR. It's all response fund from the prevention account, rather prevention account, with a little bit of federal money. And so they've been pretty stable, flat, but there's a slight increase. And again, that's all health costs and salary adjustments of labor contracts. I'm going to spend just a little bit more time on this slide 7 because it breaks down by fund source our budget. And some of the things that I would mention is that the total operating budget proposed for 18 is about a little under $82 million. About 29% of that would be federal receipts, or $24 million. About 19% would be DGF from the prevention account, the surcharge on crude oil. About 17% would be other fees. UGF is only about 19% of the department, that $15 million or so, a little bit over $15 million. So we're about 19% UGF in the whole department. And the other would be about 16% or $13 million. That's a combination of things. It's everything from admin money that we take off of our loan fund programs and funds that we get from the government and interagency receipts and miscellaneous other things. Going to page 8, now we're, and this will be presented in the order of the budget book, we're showing the different allocations and then the different components therein as put out in the budget book. The first thing I would mention is that in our UGF that we have in the department, again, it's only about 20% of the whole department, but it resides in different areas of the department. I mentioned a minute ago that there's no UGF at all in our Spill Prevention and Response Division. But if you look at by division, I'll just run through these. Air quality is about a little over 11% funded by UGF. Tom Cherian's division of administration is about 17.8%. Environmental health is about 41.83%, and water is 29.23%. And because of that difference in where the UGF resides, that's where we've looked in the past and we'll look in the future for more efficiencies and cuts, and I'll get into some examples of that. On page 8, this is the Division of Administration, which includes the Commissioner's Office. Overall, their funding sources are about split equally between UGF, DGF, federal, and other. You can see that here. About half of the Commissioner's Office, a little less than half, is UGF, and the rest federal funds. Other components of admin services have more DGF portions of our permit programs. They rely on IT and other services, and so they pay their way by putting some funds over to administrative services. Next page, we go over to the Division of Environmental Health. And again, this is one of the components that has more, division components that has more UGF in it. They've taken some larger cuts here more recently. The first item is building maintenance and operations. This is the Environmental Health Lab that we operate in Anchorage. We say it's required by statute, and it's useful for a number of purposes. One is in emergencies, you need to have an environmental health lab. Some types of emergency you have might include foodborne illnesses or outbreaks and disease in animal populations, and to be able to quickly track those, you have to have a laboratory like this to be able to do that. But also they're essential for the seafood industry to do testing of different seafood products, shellfish, before they can be sold into commerce, and also agricultural products, both sold out of the state, but also sold to federally funded institutions like schools. So that's the purpose of the lab in Anchorage. We're going to the next page. Page 10. Again, we're still on environmental health. Item there is the food safety and sanitation component. We look at that, again, as a core function of DEC, that people have safe food to eat. And it's largely supported by fees, as you can see. But if you drop down to the first item under the component is shellfish. And that's one of two areas that's pretty heavily subsidized by UGF. The fees don't cover itself. But it's a small industry, and the cost of providing the laboratory and other services to them is fairly high because of the type of testing they need. But that's one thing that where we're looking, our environmental health department is currently doing a study of fees for seafood and shellfish, but doing a careful analysis of the economics of those industries and see whether they could pay any more of their way. I'm sure that'll be a discussion with the sub,
subcommittee.
Just a clarification. Thank you, through the chair. On page 10, there's the allocation shellfish, and on page 12, there's also shellfish and food safety testing, and I wanted to know if there's a difference between those two allocations and why they're separated out.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, there's two pieces of this. The shellfish that you see on page 10, that references the program people, and on page 12, that's the laboratory services associated with the testing. It's paralytic shellfish poison that we're talking about, a bioassay, seeing if there's paralytic shellfish toxins in the product that's being sold, and since that's potential fatal, it's poison that has to be checked before it can be sold into commerce.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you look at combined both of those, it's about $700,000 for the cost relative to the shellfish industry, and so the amount that a fee is about almost $52,000 would represent about 7% of the total cost. Next item underneath there, under the food safety and sanitation component, is manufactured food, seafood processors. You can see that there's a small amount of UGF, but most of that UGF is required to get that federal money you see there, so it's almost all needed for the federal match. Overall,
and the DGF is from what source?
Fees. That would be fees.
Thank you. Commissioner, obviously we don't want to fix our budget problem, slough our responsibilities off on municipalities where it's inappropriate, but on food safety, so just the sort of restaurant and bar inspection part of things, mm-hmm. I mean, your department's conceded that we're not able to meet federal standards in terms of the restaurant inspections that we do. Have you ever considered, at least for the larger communities, transferring that function over to the larger communities? In other states, obviously, the communities do their restaurant inspections, at least, I don't know if every other state.
Yeah.
And would we lose federal funds, federal matching funds, if we did that, or would they be able to get those?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, the what you're talking about would be over on page 11, retail food inspections, and that's where we go in and inspect restaurants and other facilities that process and serve food to the public. What you said is correct, that in most other states that would be done at a county level. In Alaska, the only municipality that does food inspections is the municipality of Anchorage. So even Juneau, Fairbanks don't do this. The state does it for them. And in outlying areas, we would do it. What we generally do in the outlying areas is we would do those inspections. We go out for FDA inspections like seafood processing and that. And so it is not necessarily a high cost to us because it's largely federally funded, those trips. But it also means, as you also mentioned, which is correct, it's opportunistic. We don't go out there and inspect at the rate that's recommended by FDA. When we do go out, we try to target the most at-risk facilities. So we have looked at what we can transfer back to communities, and we look at that across the board when we do cuts, is if we're not doing it, what risk does that create to the public? Is that a risk that would be mitigated at a local level? Could they take that on, or is it something the public themselves could to address? And this is one where it's really difficult to evaluate that, one, because foodborne illnesses are largely unreported, and second, it's really hard to say how many cases of foodborne illness you prevented by your inspection because it never happened. You don't know. All you can do is look at other areas of the country where they don't do inspections, which most of it's done in other areas, so there's nothing to compare to, or you can just track it over time. So I think that it would be difficult to push back to the communities because I don't think it would be, if it's not a high priority for the states, less likely to be a high priority for them, and that we would respond to it if it becomes a crisis. That's what I worry about. But we are looking at that in all areas of our cuts, what we can push back to the municipalities, what we can't, and how we can mitigate that risk.
Just one short follow-up, Mr. Chair.
We're really taking clarification questions at this time. Since we're on it, go ahead.
Thanks. Most of the funding I noticed was DGF. What is that? What is the DGF? So maybe there isn't that much of a budget impact.
For most retail of this, food?
Yeah, on the retail food, or on the
On the retail food, it's $1.5 million DGF, and there isn't very much UGF.
Yeah, I believe that it's all fees.
Okay, so it's largely fee supported.
Yeah, it's largely fee supported, and we are looking at outreach and education and all that. Like I say, when we look at any cut that we're taking, is what risk does that create, and how we might mitigate it.
Thanks.
Representative. Yeah, thank you. So I want to continue in the discussion here because obviously, and I really appreciate your outlaying the what is covered by fees and really helping us understand. As I look through here at many of these, and some of them are deemed important and critical, do you have the authority to change those the fee structures on your own without legislation? Can you do that through regulation or through the authority of the commissioner? Mm-hmm.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's a very good question. I was going to get to it, so this helps me get to it before I run out of time. We have two statutes that authorize the department to create fees and levy fees. Both of those have restrictions in them. Some are restrictions on our direct costs, what we can recover, what percentage of direct costs we can recover, and then sometimes there's prohibitions of collecting any indirect costs or the percentage of indirect that we can collect. And so when we've gone back and evaluated those in the past, and we believe that in some areas we could increase fees and not economically impact the business. It would provide them, it would maintain a level of service that they want without impacting them economically. But for these caps, and we have worked in the last couple of years with both Senate Finance and House Finance on draft legislation to address that. And so we do have draft legislation that's been vetted in with past finance committees that we could certainly share, you know, this year with the finance committees. And we are talking with the subcommittee about that, but I think it's probably more appropriate at this level, you could tell us. But that's ready to go. But I also want to mention that it was HB 140. Yeah, there was Representative Reinbold had a bill, you might remember, several years ago that passed that requires agencies to take a hard look at the economics of any new regulations, and we do that as part of our fee evaluation. And I'd be happy to share that with any members, but we do take we have an economist that developed this for us, and we do take a hard look at any new fees and consider the economics of it. And I think we're getting much, much better at that.
Okay, thank you. And we will expect you to take up indirect expenditures with the subcommittee and come forward with recommendations, or your recommendations, as well as the proposals that come from members of the subcommittee.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We're all ready to do that. So I'm on page 11, and I'll be quick here. On the public facilities, that's pools, spas, tattoo, body art facilities, you can see that there's a fair amount of other. And what that is, that's RSA from the Commerce. There's licensing fees that they collect for tattoo and body art, and then they pass that on to us to do these inspections. Although it doesn't sound like a high priority, when you think about it, that's needles in contact with blood, and so it is a kind of a high risk from a human health standpoint, and they've asked us to maintain that service for them. Going to page 12, this we already talked about the shellfish and food safety, so I won't cover that again. And I'll move on to page 13. If I skip anything, just slow me down. Page 13, I just wanted to mention before I should start with the dairy program. This is the other one where we have fees that don't cover the service. It stands out. There's about $405,700 in costs and $405,300 UGF. There's only two dairy farms, and it takes a lot of oversight. Milk is a product that's good for human health, but a lot of other things grow in it, and so it has to be carefully watched. If you look at our UGF overall, it's about, again, $15 million. $5 million of that, approximately $5 million, these are rough numbers, is what's required for MATCH to get the federal money. and about 4 million or so would be what I call for basic service, just having the minimum level of service that you can provide but you can't charge a fee for. And about 6 million would be where the service that we're providing, we do charge a fee for it, but the service we're, the people that we're providing or the business we're providing the service to can't pay the whole fee. So that's about 6 million that we estimate in there that would be, and it's a loose term, subsidies, you know, for certain industries that we serve. And we wouldn't expect that all of them would be in a position to cover themselves. That's not feasible. At the bottom of the page, you see fish tissue testing. There's about 307,000 in DGF there. All of the fish tissue testing, which it says beneficial, I would consider it more than beneficial myself, but that's covered by Ocean Ranger fees as a result of an action by House Finance last year. There's no UGF in that anymore. Page 14, this gets, again, we're still in environmental health. Now we're talking about the drinking water program. These are public drinking water systems serving 25 more or more people. Over the last couple years, with cuts to environmental health, we eliminated our oversight of drinking water systems that serve less than 25 people. So that's, again, one of those risks that Nell's passed on, I guess, to the people that run those systems and the public they serve. Of the drinking water component, about 900,000 of that UGF is matched to get the federal money. And then the federal money, that 4.3 million, about 3.5 million of that is the public water systems management grant. We got a fair amount of money from the federal government, including about, oh, I think it's about 10 million a year,
right,
for actual to subsidize the drinking water program. A lot of that's federally funded.
And the 5% recovered by cost, is that because most of these are municipal systems or public systems instead of private?
There's a lot of small systems, a lot of small communities that we serve. And same like with the solid waste, you'll see just a little further down there. In those small communities, we, rather than charge them a fee, would much rather have them put their money into the systems or into their landfill. And so we've just made that as a policy decision that that's an area where it needs to be subsidized just because of the size of the community and what they can bear. At the bottom of the page, you can see pesticides is, there's no UGF in that. We collect registration fees. Anybody that wants to bring a pesticide to sell it or distribute it in Alaska, they register that with us. It has to be a pesticide that's been approved for uses by EPA. And then we collect a registration fee that we use to run the program. I'm on page 15 now, air quality. There's only one allocation. It's a relatively small amount of UGF, and it's a very tight division in that way. There's a number of different functions, but they're also closely integrated that it's been left as one allocation. Of the UGF, you see there, 1.7 million. About 1.4 million of that is for matching what we call maintenance of effort. That's the minimum that the federal government requires for, to get the federal money. They look at what your investment in the air program is and has to be at a certain level for you to get the federal money. That only leaves about 300,000 left to answer neighborhood complaints and hold workshops on controversial permits and to deal with non-permittee appeals where we can't recover the cost of those appeals. So that's a very, very lean division. Spill prevention response, as I mentioned earlier, there's no UGF in that. It's the DGF that you see, most of that would be from the prevention account, the surcharge on crude oil, and a little bit on refined product. There's 5% from the cruise ship passenger vessel fund because there's work that spill prevention response does in looking at contingency plans for those vessels. And there's some federal component to that because we have a number of federal contaminated sites and help support our work on that. Page 17, division of water. Looking down the third box down, Alaska Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, one of the questions that we get is on our federally delegated programs, both on the air side and the water side, are there programs that we could give back and save money? Air, like if you look back at that, it's largely fee supported, so the answer there is no. the APDS, the wastewater discharge permitting program. You can see it's largely covered by fees now with some federal money. The UGF is only $636,000. And if we gave primacy back to the federal government, we would still have to have a state program because we have state statutes that require a state-issued wastewater discharge permit. But also, under the federal program, if EPA took it back, we would still have to certify their permits consistent with state law under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. And that's the only way that you can authorize mixing zones. And just about any of our public wastewater treatment systems have mixing zones, and EPA can't authorize those. Only states can. You have to do it through the 401 cert. So we still have to have that program. I mean, I don't say I could do it for less than that amount.
Thank you, Commissioner, and if it's too detailed, you can address it in subcommittee, I guess, but the two statutes that we passed over the years taking primacy from the feds, I remember at least on one of them, if not both of them, there were roughly like $2 million costs that the state absorbed by taking over primacy. So how would it not save us that kind of money to return primacy?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we can deal with that, get into the details when we have the division director and talk about this with the subcommittee. I don't think it would save the state money. I mean, this is my rough analysis. We can go through the figures because you're still going to have a state program. And because so much of that program is now covered by fees and by federal money, the amount that we would save by giving the federal portion of that program back, I don't think would save us that much UGF. Now, the $2 million that you say, well, there's only $636 I see here. Where's the rest of it? On the next page, there's money in there for compliance. You can see that on the next page. There's UGF there. And so, yes, I guess if you gave it back to the federal government and we didn't do compliance, we cut back on compliance, you could save there, too. And we are cutting back to a degree in compliance because we're doing less travel. Now we have taken, you'll see in our proposed budget for fiscal year 18, they're taking a hit in this program, cutting UGF for travel, and that would be less inspections. So, I mean, it's a balance. But I'm just saying, if giving primacy back, I think it would take more than just giving primacy back to cut that UGF. That's my point.
We'll go to the end.
At the bottom of the page, another item you see has a fair amount of UGF in it is engineering support and plan review is about 1.4 million UGF. That would be on-site, for instance, on-site systems. It would include such things as leach fields, that sort of thing. And so what we're trying to look at ways that we can decrease that UGF without impacting the sales of homes that need certification of those systems or impacting the private sector. But we set up a stakeholder group that's trying to identify ways that we can scale back what DEC does, either send it over to the private sector and have them do certain parts of the certification or things that we could just not do anymore that wouldn't create risk or problems in the sale of properties. But and that group is active. We're pursuing that aggressively, but it's probably going to be about a year or two before we can realize some savings there, but we are pursuing that. Going on to page 18 on the we already talked a minute about compliance, but I'll then go to the surface water standards and assessment. There's 660,000 UGF. That's almost entirely matched to get the federal money there. And then on the cruise ship, at the bottom, you see that's all DGF. That's cruise ship passenger vessel fund, Ocean Ranger fund, the $4 per berth on the Ocean Ranger money that we collect. So that's all DGF supported. On to page 19, as I mentioned at the start, we have a facility construction component to our water division. We have water standards and permits on one side, and then we have facility construction on the other side. This would be Village Safe Water Municipal Grant Loan Program and the Revolving Loan Fund programs. Village Safe Water is 75% federal money, 25% state. The Revolving Loan Fund program It's actually larger than I think most people realize. We have about $700 million in assets there, which would be loans outstanding and cash. And it's money that we get in each year in grants from the federal government. Then we use it to loan out for water and sewer projects around the state. All size communities, Anchorage has relied on it heavily over the years. Larger communities are relying on it. And then we, over the last couple of years, we've taken a portion of that money on the loan receipts we get back. We're using that as to cover the admin costs of the program. So we've eliminated the UGF there. You can see it's funded by other now. So as you look at Village Safe Water, Municipal Grant Loan, and Drinking Water, you can see that there's not UGF in there. It's being funded by the loan programs themselves. Village Safe Water is doing well, Municipal Grant and Loan Program. I know I'm talking about capital budget now. There's no proposed, in the governor's proposed budget, any money for that program this year, which means more communities will be relying on the Revolving Loan Fund program. And we are paying attention to that to make sure no communities fall through the crack in their ability to get funds for water and sewer. The last item on the bottom of that page, Operation Assistance, that's our remote maintenance workers that go out and help communities when their water and sewer systems start failing, particularly in the villages. Again, that's largely federal money, and that UGF, you see there, is all matched to get that federal money. It also is the operator certification program, so there's also some fees in there for that. So that covers my presentation today.
Thank you, Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, if we could go back to the topic of shellfish testing. Did you say in your presentation that it might be a long-term goal to require more of more from the farmers themselves to cover the costs of what you do for them? Is that what you said?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I wouldn't say that we're going into it with that. We are going to do that. We're doing the economic analysis right now, and we would certainly talk with the industry. We know it's pretty small, and we also know that there's different components of it. You have the gooey ducks, you have the farmers, you have the people that collect it in areas that naturally growing shellfish. So we look at it as closely as we need to before we go in there and hurt the industry or something.
That's one of the complaints I've heard from my constituents in that particular part of the industry. The testing facilities in Anchorage, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the problem being, if you're harvesting gooey ducks and different programs or different products like that here in Southeast Alaska, there's quite a bit of turnaround time before you get testing results, things like that. Has anybody ever looked at the cost of a testing facility and whether we could perhaps locate one a little closer to proximity to the industry?
Through the chair, yes, and we're looking. There are several things that people are looking at, and there is actually a lab in Southeast that's being funded through some federal grant money to try to do that, to set up, to have a local lab, which we support. We're providing the service for the public. If somebody else, and particularly private industry, can provide it, that would be great. But what what you're up against is paralytic shellfish poison is pretty prevalent in Alaska. You see it all over the state. In Southeast, it's particularly challenging in some parts up by Haines and over by Kodiak. You see it out on the chain. Butter clams, Dungeness crab in the guts, and you can see it in the gooey ducks. And it's unpredictable. It'll be there today and gone tomorrow. And so when you go out and harvest, you have to test the area. You can't just assume that you didn't see it last year. It's not going to be there this year. It can just appear. And again, if you sent it out without, and it was hot for PSP, and somebody got sick and maybe died, you can just imagine what the impact would be on the reputation of seafood in the state. It really is a serious, serious thing, and you have to do it right. The testing itself is a bioassay, and it's pretty expensive. As you say, you have to collect the sample. You have to send the tissue sample up to our lab in Anchorage. We grind it up, and we inject it in mice, and we watch to see the effects of that. And that takes a little bit of time. And then we send the results back, and that they know whether that's a hot area or not. and we try to do that in time. And they're waiting to harvest, and before they go out there to harvest, they have to know. And so it's really tight time frames and a lot of work. And so we're very interested, and we worked with FDA and others and the industry to try to look at ways of other alternatives, but we're not there yet. But the alternative has to work because of the danger of it.
And I think Representative Foster and then we're and Representative Thompson, make them quick, so we're out of time here.
Sure. Thank you. I may have missed it. Did you mention under the governor's budget the shifting of paying for that service and using some of the cruise ship funds? Did you cover that?
No, I didn't, but that's one thing that is looking at is trying to offset some of that UGF by some cruise ship passenger vessel funds, which would be DGF.
Thank you. I just want to make sure the committee knew. Thank you.
Yeah.
And Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Larry, just out of curiosity, the paralytic shellfish toxin testing, how much of that is covered by the state, or how much does it cost to do a testing for that?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I think the test remembers about $140 per sample. Is that what you call? So it's about $140 a sample. And as I mentioned earlier, it's the whole program, if you look at the lab and the oversight of it, it's about a 7% covered by about 7% overall. Now, that $140, I don't think any of it's that part's covered by there's the $140 that it costs us to run that sample. There's no fee for that. That's covered by the industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that we are still the largest utilizer of white mice of a certain breed in the entire world, aren't we?
We use a lot of them out there, and I can tell you stories.
I think it's like 20,000 mice. They can only be a certain age, and so as soon as if they're held too long, then you can't use them. So we're hoping for the new chemical testing becomes available soon so we can get out of that. And we're going to now change testifiers, and thank you, Commissioner Hardig, for your presentation. And we'll go to the Department of Administration. Ourselves back in to order, and I wanted to let everybody know that we have about 35 minutes, so we'll go through the presentation and then come back for questions.
Okay, great. And it's my intention, we probably have more slides than we can reasonably cover in the time that we have, and so I thought I would try to prioritize slides that are that seem to me to be the most relevant. If I jump over something that you want me to talk about, then just, if you don't mind, pause and we'll back up. But jumping to slide three, kind of talking about, just to introduce the department, our primary mission is to provide efficient support services to other state agencies.
Commissioner, I think you forgot to introduce yourself.
I was so excited about. So my name is Sheldon Fisher. Thank you. I am the commissioner from the Department of Administration, and I'm here with Cheryl Lowenstein, who is our director of Admin Services in the department. Thank you for reminding me. Going to slide three, just to give a sense of the scope of functions within the department. The boxes that are highlighted in green. Are services that we provide to other state agencies. The blue ones are services we provide directly to Alaskans, and then the gray boxes reflect boards and commissions that we help facilitate the administration. And just at a high level, we're responsible for IT, the IT function. We're responsible for finance. General services and shared services are essentially merging into one, and we'll talk a little bit about that. These are the services. This is leasing, procurement, and we're taking on travel administration, accounts payables, and a few other. Division of Retirement and Benefits, where we provide the benefits for active employees and also the retirement plan and program for our retirees. And then the Division of Risk Management, which includes primarily the insurance, the property management, as well as workers' comp. Moving then to slide four, as you can see, historically, general funds are roughly a little bit over 2% of the overall state budget. They peaked in FY15 at $111 million. They're down to a little bit under about $99.5 million. About nearly a $12 million decline, and we'll talk a little bit about how that breaks out between the various divisions. And I want to spend a little bit more time on slide five. This shows both our UGF, this is a combination of UGF and DGF for each of our divisions, kind of ranked by total amount, at the top end is the Office of Public Advocacy and the Public Defender. You can see there that it appears that they've been kept relatively flat at between 15 and 18 with about $50 million. It's important to note that, I guess, a couple of things. First of all, we have attempted to protect these divisions. We think the work they do is important, and so to the extent we can, we've minimized the cuts that they've experienced. The UGF portion of their combined budget is down by about $2 million between 15 and 18. Obviously, the DGF portion then is up by about $2 million. And to put it into perspective, in fiscal year 18, open PD combined have about $46.5 million of UGF. The DGF, the $2.4 million of DGF, may or may not happen. So these agencies are able to collect fees in certain circumstances from individuals, but sometimes the collection of those fees is difficult, and the reduction of the permanent fund kind of impacts that. If they don't pay their fees, we can often garnish their permanent fund, but as the permanent fund declines, we often struggle to recover. And so even though it appears that there's not been a cut, there is, in effect, been some reductions to those organizations. The DMV is next, and this is funded 100% from DGF associated with the fees that they collect. And that is also the same for the OAGCC, which, again, is funded from industry receipts. After that, SATS and ETS are the next largest. SATS, as you may know, that refers to the State of Alaska Telecommunications Systems, and the ALMR is the Alaska Land Mobile Radio. And those are the systems that are used primarily to provide emergency telecommunications services to first responders in the state. They are funded primarily by UGF. We are able to collect a little bit from the various users that are on the network, as well as a little bit from the federal government, but most of the funding comes from UGF. I won't necessarily go through all of them. You do see we administer public television, and I guess I'll pause there. But we can talk if you want to ask questions or wait until the end if there's other large any questions there. At that point, I think I'm going to turn it over to Sherry to talk about the next few slides.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sherry Lowenstein. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Administration. How's that? This next slide on page 6 shows DOA's budget, all funding sources. As you're aware, DOA provides services to state agencies. The bulk of our funding or our spend is in the contractual line for the products and services that we provide. The bulk of the rest is personal services for the people who help provide the service, run the machines. And next, page 7. This is our UGF and our DGF. You'll see legal and advocacy is at the top, as most always. They do carry the lion's share of the UGF. Next in line is motor vehicles. They carry the bulk of the share of the receipts that we receive. Central Administrative Services has a number of our large divisions. It has finance, personnel, labor relations, retirement and benefits. So it has a number of our big divisions. It's the third in line. Alaska Oil and Gas is the next one. Again, it is based on receipts. I can go further if you'd like. Okay. The DOA appropriation, all funds, again, you'll see the Centralized Administrative Services is the top. That's really because it carries the bulk of the services that we provide, personnel, finance, those that I mentioned previously. Shared Services is the new initiative that we're doing. Most of the funding sources in that, the bulk is IA or interagency receipts. With that, we do chargebacks to agencies for the services that we provide. Legal and advocacy, again, is the third in line. They are the general funds. And the fourth one, OIT, that is another one, Office of Information Technology, that's another one of our initiatives. That also is a chargeback. It's interagency funds as well. Next page. By funding group, and you'll see that we have just a small amount of federal. You can hardly see it on the graph. It's at the top. It's generally for specific purposes. We have a little bit in DMV, a little bit in ALMR to receive funds from the DOD for services at the maintenance of the ALMR system. Other state funds is our interagency receipts. It may be called something else like Internal Services Fund or Public Billing Fund, but that is the mechanism that we use to charge and receive from other agencies. The designated general funds, again, the bulk of that is DMV and AOGCC. And then unrestricted general funds, again, that is mostly open PD.
All right, so at this point, we're going to move into kind of some specific slides around each area. And just in the interest of time, I'm going to kind of talk about the entire division and then probably move through it, and again, I will have to take questions, I guess, at the end. The Division of Finance, these are organized. The first slides we'll go through are the services we provide to other agencies, and then we'll touch on the other departments towards the end. The Division of Finance, this is the group that manages IRIS, and IRIS is the system, our accounting system. Alder is our reporting system, and they also then produce the CAFR and various audit compliance reports as required, and work with Ledge Finance to complete the audit. All total, the budget is about $10.8 million. You can see that's split roughly 50-50 between GF and then other funding, and pretty much as Ms. Lowenstein referred to, other generally refers to interagency receipts that we receive from other agencies. And similarly, then, when you look over on the percent of cost that is associated with fees, the fees that we collect are, generally speaking, from other agencies. And so hopefully that is a helpful way of calling that out. But these are, at least in this division, and with the exception of the DMV and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the fees that we receive are from other agencies. As you can see, there's 45 employees, they split roughly one-third, two-third between the accounting and the administrative functions. Moving now to slide 11, the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, we're going to talk, the first group refers to the Division of Personnel, and then we've got a separate breakout for labor relations. And so the Division of Personnel has about a $12 million budget. As you can see, far and away the majority of that is paid for through interagency receipts. There's just a modest amount of UGF that is received. There's about 120 employees. Most of what those employees are in the payroll division. This is people who get the payroll out every week. We have a relatively complicated payroll. Just the number of exceptions and the work that needs to be done. Our hope is that many of you may know that we launched this week a new module, an HR module to the IRIS system, and our hope is over time to get better information into our system so we have less of a manual processing of the payroll, and hopefully we can reduce some of the cost and personnel in that area. We also have, we perform classifications and do some training. Flipping to slide 12, and this is continuing the Division of Personnel, we have the EPIC group, or the Employee Planning and Information Center. They provide record keeping and reporting. We've got the Equal Employment Opportunity and Americans with Disability function, and then statewide recruiting. And that makes up the Division of Personnel. And then the labor relations portion has a budget of about $1.3 million. That's all paid for by UGF. There's seven individuals, and these are the ones responsible for maintaining our relationship with our bargaining units and bargaining our agreements as they arise. Moving to the Division of Retirement and Benefits, as I referred to earlier, the division handles both the benefits for our active employees as well as the retirement program for our retirees. There's about 115 people, and they have a nearly $18 million budget. In addition to that, we also, at the bottom of the page, you can see that we have we engage Aetna to administer our health care plan. Moving to the Division of Risk Management, this has most of this work is falls in two categories. One is the administration of our insurance programs for our third-party property insurance, and you can see that's the second line, insurance administration, and then the other, the bulk of it, almost $32 million, is workers' comp and some other claims management functions. The division total has a budget of about $40.8 million with five individuals. Slide 15. Continues the Division of Risk Management. These are fairly modest responsibilities. We review contracts to ensure that we've got proper insurance. About half of a person spends their time on it. And then we've got a as part of our workers' comp, we've got a return to work function or program where we try to bring people into a function. Maybe they can't go back to the job they had, but there's some light duty work and different things they can do that, that can add value to the state and allow them to be productive. Moving then to shared services. I think we've presented this in the past, and we can come back another time and go into detail, but the short story is that we are working to take those functions that all agencies perform and centralize them and then redesign the process in an effort to improve efficiency, reduce steps, streamline the process. And so the entire division, and we have...
And we can, you know, we've had this in each department, so we can go ahead and talk about this with the subcommittee and skip over shared.
Okay, great. All right, moving then to slide 17. There's a number of slides on the topic of the Office of Information Technology, and I think I have shared that we have a similar initiative underway to provide to develop shared services like approach in the area of IT. We're not combining it with shared services because IT is such a specialized area, but we have hired a new CIO. Yesterday was his first day, and so we're excited to begin the path there. And so the first the total budget of ETS today is about $47.5 million, and you can see that the first two budget items are the first one being the new chief information officer in his in that office where there'll be two individuals, and then you see that we'll be transferring other department IT staff into this organization and starting in fiscal year 18, and so you can see in the next line item about $9 million there. The rest of the what I'm going to describe to you are our current operations, and so the first is a database function. We've got the mainframe and the databases associated with it, and then Oracle and SQL databases and a number of applications that we administer in this group. There's about 18 people with about $4.2 million of a budget associated with it. Moving to slide 18, still on the topic of IT, we have a hosting function where we host services. We have our servers, and we have virtual servers that we offer to other departments and provide that service. There's 29 people and about nearly $15 million in that function. The network services, this is our wide area network or the connectivity between all of our offices, and this includes, you know, both the major offices but then also all of the satellite and smaller offices around the state, and that's nearly $12 million with 12 full-time employees. Security, we spend about $3 million with 9 employees, and then there's kind of an administrative function that includes kind of procurement, the fiscal, and the leadership functions with 18 personnel and $3.3 million. We have presented the SATs and ALMR a little bit broken out from the rest of ETS, and the entire cost, as we showed before, there was about $6.7 million of UGF. And then there's another $1.9 million that we received from the Fed and the federal government, and then just a modest amount that we received from other users. And you can see that breaks roughly, the SATs portion is about $4.4 million and the ALMR is about $3.2 million. Moving then to our administrative services division, 13 people, about $2.6 million. I think it's fairly typical in terms of the function there, so I'll move over past that. All right, so the Division of Motor Vehicles, We discussed earlier, it's got about $16.5 million of DGF. This is all fees that we collect from residents, and about 149 full-time and other 5 part-time employees. Unless you'd like, I'm not going to take the time to go through each of the offices and the functions, but we can in the Q&A if there's an interest to
do that. And just a question on the entire division there. It says 151.2 of other funds are uncollectible.
Sure. Can you respond? In other words, there's one. Yeah, go ahead.
I can. That's interagency receipts. They had thought they had a need for that at one time with an agreement with DMVA. That agreement did not come through, and it is unrealizable. Well, they don't have anything to bill an agency for.
Okay. Thank you.
So then we're moving now to services, I guess, with the DMV, but the Office of Public Advocacy also provides services to the public. The primary function, it's about 30% criminal work and about 70% civil work. The criminal work is primarily providing representation in cases where the public defender is conflicted out. And the civil work is primarily associated with public guardians, and that is providing a guardian for wards of the state, adults who are unable to care for themselves. And then guardian ad litem and the CASA program, this is associated with children, primarily foster children. And then, there's a handful of other small functions. The court visitor is a program where we provide some work for the court around the effectiveness of the guardian program. The civil custody is situations where it's comparable to the guardian ad litem program, but it applies where parents are getting a divorce, and if it becomes particularly challenging for the children, then we step in and provide a service there. The other big one on this page are the child in need of aid cases, and this is it's kind of somewhat similar. We're providing representation to parents when there's a question about whether the children should be perhaps taken out of the home. And in these cases where we're providing criminal services, it's court mandated to us by the court, and that's also true with the guardianship cases. Finally, we provide some elder fraud, and this is where we defend elderly individuals that have been perhaps defrauded of some of their assets, and where there's an opportunity to recover, we will represent them in a civil action to try to recover.
Mr. Chairman? Just a clarification. So on the parent China representative civil, I thought you said it was representation for the China cases, but then you said something about it being for criminal as well.
If I did, that was a misstatement. What I think I was meaning to say was these China cases are similar to the criminal defense cases. We're representing parents, and it's ordered to us by the court. The court directs us to take these. So I didn't mean to imply that they were criminal in any nature.
A follow-up. So is that the conflict attorneys? I mean, is that where that sits at? I see public defenders in here, and I know the guardian litems. I'm just trying to figure out where this fits with the parents.
So these are civil cases where it's not just a conflict. These are cases where there's an action against the family, or an action involving the family, I guess I should say. And if the family is indigent and can't afford representation, then we're asked to represent the parents.
Mr. Chairman, we might use our own terminology. So conflict attorneys, I guess that's what we call them, because public defenders have one of the parents. And then I don't know what we call the other attorneys, so we call them the conflict attorneys. So we know they're for the parents. So these are the other attorneys that aren't the public defenders for the other parent in these cases.
Right.
Okay. Sorry, we kind of use our own terminology sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you.
If the public is watching, China is?
Child in need of aid. Forgive me.
Thank you.
Sorry.
No, thank you. And then the last agency that delivers services to the public is the public defender. There's nearly $26 million, approximately 170 individuals, and you can see that it breaks down by criminal trials, civil trials, which is predominantly child in need of aid cases, and appeals. The last pages, I guess I would propose we not spend time on. These are, I'm happy to, but these are those boards and commissions, and so I thought maybe it would be, given the time and the time I've taken, maybe it would be appropriate to take questions at this time, unless you'd like me to continue.
Just one question on that following page. WCAC recruitment is listed as status quo.
Sorry.
Does that mean that does not really address the mission? I don't see. 25. It's after 24.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it would be 25, but it's not labeled.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Workers. Okay.
The office administrative hearing is tasked by statute to recruit members of the workers' comp board and commission. And so that's just that function. And, I guess they struggle to know, well, maybe it's serving all Alaskans. I guess they're either saying it's kind of not a relevant question, or it serves all of the Alaskans. Does that make sense?
So that's a tenth of one employee. I mean, it's just something.
Yes.
Yeah. In the office, but it's not interfering with your office. I mean, your department's work.
Well, I think that's fair. Although, if the Office of Administrative Hearings were here, they would say that these kind of little things kind of are a nuisance factor to them. I mean, you're right, it's kind of listed as one-tenth of an employee, but it is the director that spends most of her time doing it, so it's a relatively high-level employee.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions? Reverend Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is another one. Sometimes you have things in silos for child in need cases because they're in health and social services, courts, and then here. So if I add up these amounts, in the administration, we're spending in UGF almost $15 million on these cases every year. I took the...
And so you're adding up the $5.4 million of OPA and
yes.
The $4.8 million in public defender?
And then the 4.6 that we have in the parent... Well, we have the guardians ad litems at 4.6.
Okay, fair enough. The guardian ad litems, though, are not necessarily child in need of aid. The guardian ad litems principally are associated with foster children.
Mm-hmm. Follow through? Following something. So every case that is a child in need of aid, they all have a guardian ad litem, because, of course, once they're taken by the Office of Children's Services, they get a guardian ad litem who stays with them until they get adopted out. So those all are within that department.
Through the chair, yes, I agree with you. I mean, it may not be just in the duration of the case, of the what we might think of as a child in need of aid case. That has a certain duration, but if the child is taken out of the home, then that has an ongoing relationship.
Through the chair.
Wilson.
I'm sorry, but that's not correct. As long as the Office of Children's Services have legal custody of them throughout the entire time, they are part of OCS with a caseworker. They are in foster care, you're absolutely correct, but until they're actually adopted out, they are part of Health and Social Services and underneath those. And the guardian litems stay with that child until that point.
Through the chair, I think I was trying to say that very thing. In other words, what I meant is the representation of the parent may last a shorter period of time. The guardianship, you're absolutely right, emerges from that proceeding, but has a longer life. So yes, I agree with your characterization.
And Mr. Chair, my point really is that we can't just look at the $15 million, but there'll be another amount in health and social services, and then there's a lot of the court time that's also taken up in these cases that also has another figure. So when we're looking at things like this, you can't always just look in one department.
Totally agree that families that are in disruption are very expensive to the state.
We want to get them back together.
And we do want to get them back together, and we want to take care of the kids. So are there other questions for the Department of Administration? I guess I have one. I don't quite sure where your health, health is being our biggest cost driver in almost every department. And so I will expect you to be talking with the subcommittee about how you're going to work towards reducing the cost of health care, whether that's through prevention or other means. So I just want to put that on the record that the expectation is that that will be addressed in subcommittee, because we can't just keep paying for sickness. We got to somehow have initiatives that reduce the poor health of Alaskans.
Thank you. We agree, and we'll be happy to engage in that discussion.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we are about to adjourn. I'll announce that our next meeting will be January 30th. It's Monday at 1:30 p.m., and we'll hear our overviews from the Department of Law, Fish and Game, and Corrections. And are there any other questions or comments? Seeing none, we will be adjourned at 3:29.